Welcome to Your Move with Andy Stanley. In this weekly 30-minute podcast, you'll discover how to make better decisions and live with fewer regrets. So check out our website at yourmove.is for additional ways to watch, listen, and connect. Today is the third part in the 6-part series entitled Recovery Road. What should we expect from the private behavior of our public figures? And should a candidate's integrity affect our votes? Listen as Andy introduces us to an Old Testament leader who demonstrated one important qualification we should demand of all of our leaders today.
We're in this series, Recovery Road, because our nation is focused on our national recovery. And I just feel like whenever our nation is focused on something and that something intersects with the scripture, then people like me should talk about it. So for the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about it, and we're going to continue that today. And really the big takeaway, if I could push a button for all of you who are watching, all of you who live in this country specifically, and our local churches, it would be that we would be able to look at our politics through the filter of our faith, rather than looking at faith through the filter of our politics. Because I'm convinced, and maybe you're kind of getting the sense in these last 2 weeks, and hopefully today will be another step in that direction. I believe it's not about left or right, that there is a third way. We're going to look at a story from the Old Testament, and because this is one of the most remarkable recovery stories ever. It's certainly one of the most remarkable recovery stories, maybe the most remarkable recovery story in the Bible. It has national implications, and there is a huge, 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 huge lesson in this story for all of us. Around 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonians, came into Jerusalem and came into Israel and destroyed the temple and destroyed the walls and took a bunch of guys prisoner and kind of just put an end to Israel as a superpower. If you grew up in church, you remember the story of Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all that kind of stuff. That happened during that period of history. 50 years later, things had changed in the world, and the Babylonians were no longer the superpower. The Persians were. And under King Cyrus, something very interesting happened 50 years later. He looked around what was Babylon, that was now an expanded empire we call Persia, and he looked around, and there were all these foreigners that the Babylonians had brought in whenever they would destroy a nation. And he said, look, let's send these people home. And so he declared an edict, and about 50,000 Jewish people left Babylon, or what was Babylon, what was now Persia, and went back to Israel to try to rejuvenate that nation and rejuvenate that economy. Time goes by, and now King Artaxerxes sits on the throne of the Persian Empire. And King Artaxerxes was continuing the habit of the Persians to send people home, send them back to their nations. Well, he just happened to have an official that worked with him. He was referred to as a cupbearer, the cupbearer to the king, who was Jewish. And he actually had been born in captivity, and all he knew was the Persian Empire. But because he was very, very smart, very, very on the ball, he was close to the king of Persia. And when we think of a cupbearer, we think of somebody that's like a wine taster or somebody that's going to make sure the king's food isn't poisoned. And that may have been part of his job, but his responsibility was much broader than that. And this man had spent so much time with the most powerful person in the world, there is no doubt that he'd picked up some incredible leadership lessons along the way. And his name was Nehemiah. And at one point in the story, or the way the story begins in actually the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah is with King Artaxerxes, and Nehemiah's brother, who had been in Jerusalem, visited Nehemiah in the Persian capital. And Nehemiah said to his brother, "How are things going in Jerusalem? How are things in our homeland?" Now, we aren't sure that Nehemiah had ever been there. We know he wasn't born there, and there's a good chance he had never even visited his homeland because he was enslaved in some ways and had gained this great responsibility with King Artaxerxes. And so his brother says, "Nehemiah, I don't know how to tell you this. It's worse than ever. The gates are burnt. There are no walls. Things are disorganized. The economy is terrible. Most of the citizens are enslaved to outsiders and foreigners. They've had to leverage their houses, their businesses, their crops. They've even had to use their wives and children as collateral for all the loans they've taken out. Things are absolutely chaotic." And in the book of Nehemiah, when he gets this news, it breaks his heart. And he begins to weep, and he begins to pray. and he says, God, I want to do something for my people. I want to do something for my people. And he begins to pray that God would give him favor in the eyes of King Artaxerxes, and King Artaxerxes would allow him to leave his responsibilities in the capital city of Persia and go to Jerusalem and do something for his people. It's an incredible prayer. So one day when the king is in a good mood, because that's important, approaches everything, he goes to the king and he says, King Artaxerxes, here's the news I've received. It's broken my heart. Would you give me an extended leave of absence to go to Jerusalem and see if I can bring some order to the chaos of my homeland? King Artaxerxes says, yes. And I'm actually going to make you the governor of that province, because Jerusalem was beholden to, and the nation was beholden to the Persian Empire at that point. I'm going to make you the governor, and I'm going to give you letters to every single king or leader between here and there to support you and to help you and to give you anything you need in order to make your journey successful, as long as you'll promise me that eventually you'll come back and serve me. Well, as they begin their work, Nehemiah begins to understand that the biggest impediment, the thing that's going to hold them back more than anything else, is that the men in particular, the leaders of the households, were so indebted to the surrounding rich people and the surrounding nations and the surrounding merchants that they were so afraid that if they missed a single payment, they're going to lose their land, they're going to lose their farms, they could lose their daughters, they could lose their sons, they could lose their wives. And he realized, if I'm going to get their undivided attention to get this wall built, I've got to do something about our economy. So Nehemiah dips into his own personal resources and the money that the king had given him to get the job done, and he goes around and he finds out who owes who what, and he begins to pay the debts of the people personally so they can get their homes back in their names, their land back in their names, they can begin to relax a little bit, things begin to go better, people are kind of feeling a lift in their spirit, and then Nehemiah discovers something that makes him so mad he can hardly see straight. Just as things were beginning to go well, they're beginning to work on the wall, everybody had an assignment, it's one of the most organizationally rich books of the Bible, he discovers that the wealthy Jews in Jerusalem and the wealthy Jews in the surrounding area saw this as a business opportunity for themselves. And here's how they thought. They thought, oh, Money Bags is here. Look at him. He's going around and he's paying off everybody's debts, which means if we can figure out how to get these Jews indebted to us, we've got to guarantee that our loans are going to be paid off. And they began to work through some of the Gentiles and through some of the people that they knew outside of Jerusalem to move these people and to trick some of these people back into debt, to re-leverage their property, re-leverage their houses. And so the rich Jewish people, some from the previous royal family, some merchants who had just become wealthy through the years, they begin to take advantage of the situation and put the people of the city back into debt to them. And Nehemiah finds out. Now, he has spent an enormous amount of his own wealth to get them out of debt. And now the people within the city, his own Jewish brothers, have begun to undo all that he's done. And he is furious. And that's where the story picks up. Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 6. When I heard their outcry, the outcry of the people, and these charges, I was very angry. Can you imagine how betrayed he must have felt? I pondered them in my mind. Throughout the book of Nehemiah, you find Nehemiah bumping up against tough circumstances and pausing. He's an incredible leader. Doesn't react, he pauses. I pondered them in my mind, and then I accused the nobles, these are the leftovers from the noble family from generations back, and the officials. And here's what I told them. I told them, you are charging your own people interest? What? I mean, in the Old Testament, when God set up the nation of Israel, he said, you are to be a nation that loans. You are not to be a nation that borrows. You are to be a nation that owns. You are not to be a nation that borrows. And you should not charge your own people interest. If you want to charge interest, charge the Gentiles interest. Don't charge your own people interest. So this wasn't exactly against civil law, but it was against the custom and the tradition of the Jewish people. You're charging your own people interest? So he called a meeting. So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, so he's got all the nobles and all the rich people and all the power brokers that are all in the room together, all gathered together. And he said, as far as possible, we, talking about himself and his group that came from Persia, we have bought back our fellow Jews who were sold to the Gentiles. In other words, I spent my own money to solve this problem. I spent my own money to free them up so they could work on the wall. And now you are selling your own people only for them to be sold back to us. So they'd figured out a scam because they knew Nehemiah was going to come along and pay their debts. And so they figured out a way to enrich themselves off of Nehemiah's generosity and patriotism. Can you imagine how mad he was? And listen to their response. And they kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. Now, I said there were no miracles in the book of Nehemiah. This might be the miracle right here, okay? You got a bunch of rich guys, the power guys, the, you know, we've had it in our family, we got it going on, we got the largest farms, and suddenly they're being faced down by a guy who's really relatively new to town, who doesn't really have any kind of personal leverage other than the fact that he's got letters from the king of Persia who's far, far away, and they're speechless. So I continued, it says. So I continued, what you are doing is not right. Now, it may not be illegal, you know. There may not be a specific law on the books. And I realize that this has been going on for generations. But you know in your heart you are taking unfair advantage of people who aren't as educated as you. You're taking unfair advantage of people who aren't as wealthy as you. You're taking unfair advantage of people who are part of you. They're you. It's fellow Jews. What you're doing isn't right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? He's saying, look, what do you think the people outside this city, outside this nation think of us when we're taking advantage of our own people? What's wrong with you? Then he goes on. I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain. It's not that we're not aware of need, but let us stop charging interest. In other words, if people need something, loan it to them, give it to them, but quit trying to enrich yourself off the disadvantaged people around us. Give back to them immediately their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and houses, and then check this out, and also the interest you are charging them. 1% of the money, grain, new wine, and olive oil. They were charging 12% an annual, basically the equivalent of 12% annual interest on all this stuff. And then we're going to come around and collect it from Nehemiah. And here's how they responded. We will give it back, they said, and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say. And Nehemiah looks at him and says, I'm not buying it. Look what he did. Then I summoned the priest and made the nobles officials take an oath to do what they'd promised. I don't trust you. Anybody that would do what you've done, I don't trust you. I thanks for saying it, but we're going to take it a bit further. Then he said this, I also shook out the folds of my robe. This is sort of an ancient curse is what he did. I shook out the folds of my robe and I said, in this way, may God shake out their houses and possessions. Anyone who does not keep this promise, so may such a person be shaken out and emptied. It's like, if you think you're going to get by with this, God's going to get you. That's basically what that meant. At this, the entire assembly, or the whole assembly, said, amen, and praise the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. Tragedy averted. Now, you hear a story like that, and you know, you try to picture like the president, or you know, somebody facing down business leaders, or people in the banking industry, or some group that you think has, you know, taken unfair advantage of poor people or uneducated people, whatever it is. And it's just hard to imagine a group of people in suits and ties, you know, and you know, business suits and cool shoes, going, yes, you're right. We're going to pay back everything we took, and we're going to, you know, pay back the interest too. It's just hard to imagine. But there's a part of this story that you don't know yet, unless you've read the book of Nehemiah. Here's what we find out he had been doing all along. Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, until his 32nd year, in other words, 12 years total, as he flashes back through this story, now this is amazing. Neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. Now, what that means is this. As the governor of Judea, as the governor of this area, he was entitled to a percentage of all the grain, all the crops, all the land, all the wealth. In other words, he had the opportunity to come in as the governor and say, I'm going to impose on you the governor's tax. You have to give me a percentage of everything. After all, I'm the governor. And Nehemiah said, when I showed up, I decided not to take everything I was entitled to. But the earlier governors, Those preceding me placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver, about a pound of silver, from them in addition to the food and the wine. And not only the governor, the assistants, their assistants also lorded over them. In other words, the previous governors were surrounded by these cronies who just went out and leveraged their position and authority for their own benefit. But out of reverence for God, don't you love that? Not because I had to, not because somebody made me, but just out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Instead, he says, instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. This is so huge. In other words, he said, I came here to get this wall built. So that's what I focused on. I came here to get this job done. That's what I focused on. All my men, not just me, all my men assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. This is huge as well. The way you enriched yourself in that ancient culture is much like today, but even more so then. Whoever owned the land basically owned the resources. And as a wealthy person coming in to a very depressed economy, there were lots of good land deals. And he told his guys, we do not purchase land. We are not going to leverage our power and wealth to become wealthier and more powerful. We are not going to purchase any land. He goes on. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table as well as those who came from the surrounding nations. And in spite of this, he says, in spite of this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor because the demands were heavy on these people. And then he closes this little section this way. This is awesome. Remember me with favor, my God, for all I have done for these people. So when Nehemiah gathered the wealthy and the powerful, they were eyeball to an eyeball with a guy who had not only obeyed the law, but had gone above and beyond. They were eyeball to eyeball with a guy who was entitled as the governor and never took what he was entitled to. They were eyeball to eyeball with a guy who said, I've come to build this wall and I'm not going to allow myself or my people to be distracted by wealth, by power, by entitlement, by opportunity. We are here to get this wall built and that's what we're going to do. When he stepped up and demanded of the rich and powerful that they do what was best for the nation, they were shamed into doing it because they were looking at a guy whose words had matched his actions at the deepest, deepest level, to a level where it had actually cost him financially. Nehemiah had something that went beyond the authority of his position. Nehemiah had what we refer to as moral authority. It goes beyond position. Moral authority, just to throw out a simple definition, is simply the credibility, and that's the key word. It's the credibility you earn by walking your talk. It's the credibility you earn when people look at you and say, I may not believe what he believes, but there's no doubt in my mind that he believes what he says he believes. Now, here is the interesting and I think tragic thing about our nation currently. About 13 years ago, we began basically a national debate over the question of, is a man or a woman's personal life important as it relates, or isn't there any relationship between their personal life and their authority or their position in government? I mean, does it really matter how a man or woman handles their finances personally or their morality or their ethics? Can there be a division? So on one hand, as a public official, they can do X, but personally they can do Y. And does it really matter that the two don't line up? And we, the American people, have voted on that. And we've all weighed in on that debate. And here's what we've concluded. We've concluded, yes, it matters. No, it doesn't matter. We've concluded, yes, it matters when it's the person in the other political camp that messes up. Then it matters. There should be consistency. I can't believe they would say this and do that. But when it's the person in my political camp that messes up, well, I don't think it matters that much. So today, since we're no longer looking at our faith through the filter of our politics, we're looking at our politics through the filter of our faith, we're going to all agree together with God. The Jewish scriptures and the Christian scriptures and common sense, and just think back to your daddy and your mama, we know in our gut and in our heart, yes, it matters. Yes, it matters if there's alignment between what a person says publicly and what they do privately. Yes, it matters if there's a difference or if there's duplicity between what they represent publicly and how they live their lives privately. Of course it matters. If we want our national leaders to have credibility, of course it matters. If we want our national leaders to have influence beyond their position, yes, it matters. It is okay to ask those who represent us, it is okay to ask them to be beyond reproach in their personal finances, in their personal morality, in their personal ethics. That's not a lot to ask. Now, I can already hear because you hear, and you know, maybe you're one of those that goes, whoa, hold on, preacher, that's easy for you to say up there, all cool and everything with every preaching to the choir. But hey, nobody's perfect. We're all just human, to which I want to say, this is not the Homeowners Association. This is the United States of America. Come on. We have asked you to represent our country. Now, recovery begins when moral authority supersedes re-election as the value of choice among our national leaders. That I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian or Tea Party or don't go to parties or whatever you are, at the bottom line is this, we want men and women in leadership whose walk matches their talk. And we want them to value that more than they value re-election, right? So here's the bottom line. If you're a national leader, and you have a secret, and it's a secret that if it were to become public would embarrass our nation, embarrass your family, embarrass the people you represent, and detract from what you're there to do, please, please don't run for re-election, Republican or Democrat, I don't care. And if you have a secret that is on the verge of being found out, just resign now. You don't have to wait. We'll applaud that, you know, that element of your integrity, okay? If you're not paying your taxes, if you're not paying your property tax, if you're leveraging your position to get away with things that the average person can't get away with, don't run for re-election. In fact, we would prefer that you just step down now. If you're a functioning alcoholic and you know that your alcoholism is detracting from your ability to do your job, don't run for re-election. If you're a prescription drug user and it's a habit and you're breaking the law to get the drugs that you need, stuff that we're not allowed to do, don't run for re-election. In fact, I would say this, if you're having an affair and you say, well, that's my private life, that's my personal life, there are enough Americans who've had affairs that understand you cannot create a dividing wall between your personal moral conduct and your public conduct and your professional conduct. Eventually, they merge. Just don't run for re-election. And please, if you could just step down. And then I just want to throw one out personally. This is just me talking. This is me, okay? I'm not representing the church. If on your income tax, you give away less than 3% off the top to charity, don't run for re-election. If you can't learn to be generous with your own personal money, I don't want you making decisions about how to be generous with mine. Just don't run for re-election. It's simple. Now, here's what we know. Okay, here's what we know. Red and yellow, black and white, you know, Republican, Democrat, extreme. Here's what we know. If you get a Republican Nehemiah in the room with a Democrat Nehemiah, and you fill the room with Nehemiahs, they will figure out how to fix the economy. They will figure out how to solve our problems. And here's why. Because if you get that group of people together that are there to build the wall, we've come here to build a wall and we don't have any other hidden agenda. We don't see the world the same way. We don't share the same values, but there's no duplicity. I'm looking at someone that sees the world politically different from me, but I know they walk their talk and they're looking at me. They know I walk my talk. We can figure this out. It's not that difficult because you know what? At the end of the day, it is the integrity of an individual that relates to and causes integrity in their decisions. Listen, here's what the wisest king who ever lived said. The wisest king who ever lived. Here's how he summed it up. I memorized this years ago. The integrity of the upright guides them. But the unfaithful, or another translation says the fools, or another translation says the simple or the naive, are destroyed by their duplicity. We have all seen what happens when there is duplicity in leadership. It eventually seeps into their professional, marketplace, political decisions. If you're going to lie to your wife, who would you not lie to? Tell me. If you would lie to your children, who would you not lie to? Tell me. If you are dishonest in the way you handle your personal money, why would we think you wouldn't be dishonest in the way that you view and handle our money? My point is this. We don't have time for any more of that, regardless of what side of the aisle you sit on. We are in desperate need of this, and if we can fill the ranks of our leadership with men and women of personal and political integrity, not only will we recover financially, perhaps by God's grace, we can recover at even a deeper level as a nation. So here's what I want you to pray. I know you're going to vote. You better vote. We got to vote, right? And I know you're probably going to vote along whatever party lines you've always voted with, but would you be willing to pray beyond your party lines? Would you begin in a practical way, begin to view your politics through the filter of your faith? And would you begin to pray, God, give us Nehemiahs. God, give us Nehemiahs. God, give us Nehemiahs. Because you see, here's the thing that all of our elected officials have in common. They were elected. So at the end of the day, it really is about me, not them. It's about we, not they. Because the wonderful thing about our nation and the wonderful thing about our system is they all get elected. And as easy it is and as fun as it is to get all amped up and all ramped up about what he did and what she did and what he said and what she said, you just remember this. They are all there because we elected them. And if the church of the Lord Jesus Christ, the red, yellow, black, and white church, the Republican, Democrat church, the Libertarian church, the Tea Party church, the whatever, if just the Christians in this nation would say, God, beyond my political, you know, badge, beyond my political voting record, we want Nehemiahs in the White House and to fill Congress. God, give us men and women whose walk matches their talk personally, politically, professionally, at every level. If God will answer that prayer, then we'll recover. We'll go beyond recovery. We'll be the nation that continues to impact the world with the gospel, that continues to be the most generous nation in the world. But we have to look beyond politics. We have to look beyond even our own past voting record. We have to look beyond our own worldview and our own prejudices and say, God, would you please grace us with Nehemiahs and then give me the courage as an individual, as an American citizen, to make a decision not based primarily on my political persuasion or worldview or the way I was raised, but on what the scripture says, on what I know is true and what I know that ultimately you want for our nation. We need men and women who have more than the authority that comes with their position. We need men and women who have moral authority.
Thanks so much for listening to Your Move with Andy Stanley. We hope today's podcast will help you make better decisions and live with fewer regrets. So check out our website at yourmove.is for additional ways to watch, listen, and connect.